Hey guys, welcome to the Outward Conversation Podcast. Today we have a really special guest, as in when I first started doing this podcast, this was one of the first people that popped into my mind that I wanted on the podcast. Anybody who's heard me talk at any Outward event or anything, I have probably mentioned going to Peru a couple times. And this is the lady who hosted me while I was in Peru, 2 out of the 3 trips that I was there. And her name is Lyndall Maxwell, and her story has always stood out to me, at least the bits and pieces of the story that I know. Lyndall, thank you for being on here with us today.
Pleasure to be here.
So to jump straight into it, whenever I met you in Peru, I think the first year was either 2015 or 2016 when I came over on a 2-week trip with about 8 or 9 other people, I believe. And then going home from that trip, me and one other guy was like, we're going to turn around and come back pretty instantly. So we came back for about 8.5 weeks. And I think due to snow and stuff over here, that ended up being pushed back to about 7 weeks because we couldn't fly out as early as we wanted to. But over that 7 to 8 week trip, we got to stay with you and I got to hear a lot of your story about how you ended up in Peru. How do you get called into full-time mission work so far from your home and you actually do it?
Yeah, so I grew up in a pretty standard house, a mum and a dad. We went to church every Sunday. I'd never left the country until I was 17. And when I was 17, a former missionary couple had come back to Australia to live, and they were going to the church that I was attending and trying to inspire the youth group to sort of look for what God wants in your life. And so I went to the youth group there, and then they planned a trip to the Philippines, and I thought, oh, that'll be great. Here in Australia, I don't know what you guys do, but in Australia, when you finish high school — we finish high school at 17 — when you finish high school, you take a trip, you go somewhere and just celebrate sort of your freedom from formal schooling. So I thought, oh, the Philippines will be a good trip. I'll get to go with some friends and see something new. And that's what I did. But if you've never left Australia and you go to the Philippines, and we were ministering on some of those squatter settlements that are built on the side of the big rubbish tips and things like that, it's really a shock if you've never been exposed to anything like that, and I hadn't. And, we got out of the airport. It's filthy, it's noisy, there's smog, there's people talking in a language I don't understand. And during those 3 weeks that I was there, I was talking to people and couldn't communicate with them, found that frustrating, was eating foods that I'd never eaten before. And I mean, I think I probably lost about 10 kilos while I was over there because I just didn't like the food and didn't like the heat. It's really hot over there. And probably about halfway through, I thought, well, the one good thing about this trip is I know I'm obviously not called to be a missionary because, you know, I don't like anything about it. And then towards the end of our time there, we went to a particular squatter area, and basically we were paired up with a Filipino person who could speak the language, and they sort of translated for us, and we were there just to directly share God's message of salvation to whoever would listen. And on the last day, we're heading back to the car, and I'm so grateful that we're done with that, that I don't have to deal with the smells and with the sights and everything. We got one day of shopping before we get on the plane to go back to Australia. And we're heading back to the car, and suddenly this little old lady comes out of her house, her little shack there, and is beckoning to us. And I said to my Filipino partner there, I said, "Oh, no, no, we don't have time. We're heading to the car now. They'll be waiting for us." And she said, "Oh, no, we have time. Let's go in." And we went into her house, and, oh, my goodness, it was all I could do not to throw up, literally, because the smells were so intense there. And she said, "Okay, share your story." And so I did. I probably didn't do it very well because I was so overwhelmed with everything else that was going on. But that lady prayed the prayer of salvation. And as we were walking back to the car, my Filipino partner said to me, "That lady is, that old lady has been waiting her whole life for someone, because when she was a child, she looked for the answer, like, who is God and how can I get to know God and how can I be saved?" And God had said to her, "One day someone will come and talk to you and tell you the truth." And when she saw us coming, somehow she knew that we were the ones that were bringing the message, and that's why she ran out of her house and insisted that we come in. And that just really, really impacted me. I thought, cool. That lady, maybe 60 years, maybe 70 years, has been waiting to hear God's message of salvation. And in Australia, I have the opportunity to walk into pretty much any church and find out. And God really used that to show me. It was as if he spoke into my heart. Well, he did speak into my heart, and he said, "That's what mission work is. It's not about the smells. It's not about the heat. It's not about the food. It's not about the language. It's about people who don't have the opportunity to hear about me." And
so good.
That's when I said, "Okay, I'll go where you want me to go." And that's pretty much the call that God put on my life at that moment, 17 years old.
That's awesome. One of the big questions we get asked here, or anybody does whenever they're going to go on one of these trips, why are you spending so much money to go over there just to stay for a couple of weeks? Wouldn't it help more if you just sent your money to people who are already there? And I remember we were talking to you about that, and you told us what they really want is your time, just to be able to see that you're here side by side. Because during that time, me and the guy that I was there with, Evan, we were working with some of the guys doing the construction. I hope that we were helpful in some way. But you told us then that, like, they just liked that we were there. They liked that we sacrificed our time to come do things their way, not try to teach them how to do it our way, or not try to make, you know, whatever it is, but we came there to just be with them. And you were just telling us how important that was. And I thought one of the coolest things, and I still talk about this a lot, is after about a week or so, the construction workers started including me and Evan whenever they would have tea during the day. And like, we couldn't really talk to them. They couldn't really talk to us, but that didn't stop us from like picking on each other. Like there was still just constant picking on each other, even though no one could say anything. And it just felt like you were 100% accurate. And like, it was just cool that we were there. Like, yeah, we could have sent money, we could have donated whatever, but like, it was helpful for us to just be there because we got to learn from them just as well as us showing them, hopefully showing people the heart of Christ by being willing to not just send help from far away, but being able to, you know, come to where they are, come to where, you know, they could use extra hands. And I thought there was always something really cool with that, is just, I guess, being there. I know it helped me a lot. So how did you go from going on that trip to basically being permanent in Peru?
Yeah, so I came back all excited, told everyone who would listen, you know, I'm going to be a missionary. And they'd say, oh, good, what are you going to do? And I'd say, oh, I don't know. I don't know yet. And they said, where are you going to go? Oh, I don't know yet. And when are you planning on going? Oh, I don't know that yet either. And they'd say, okay. So I went to uni. I studied medical imaging. And when I graduated from that, I thought, okay, I've got my degree. I'm ready to go. And I sent out a bunch of letters to mission agencies saying, medical imaging technician in Australia is called a radiographer. So I wrote to them, said, I'm a radiographer and, I feel God's calling me to the mission field and wondering how you could use me. Well, almost none of the mission organizations actually responded to me, and I was a bit disheartened. One did write back and said, well, what's a radiographer do? And I thought, well, if you don't know what one is, you probably don't need one. So I thought, oh, I must have just heard wrong from God. And and then the opportunity came up for me to do further studies, and I did a specialty in ultrasound. And towards the end of that, there was a mission conference in town. I'm doing all my final exams, so I'm studying. And a friend of mine came over and said, oh, Lyndall, it's a great conference. They've got a great speaker. You should come. And I thought, oh, no, I've got to study. But anyway, one night I felt really the pressure to the pushing to go. And so I went there, and I got there a bit late, standing in the foyer of the auditorium. And up on one wall was a big lot of tickets, sort of little speech cards. And on it, when I looked closer, it was all job vacancies that all the missions. So it was a mission conference where about 40 missions were represented, and they'd all put up situation vacant on this wall. And I was thinking to myself, what a waste of time. How would you ever find a job that you might be qualified for in these? There must have been close to 1,000 tickets up on that wall. And as I'm thinking this to myself, my eyes fell on a card that said, urgent need for radiographer in Ecuador. And I thought, what? So I talked to them, and that's how I ended up, firstly in Ecuador, in a little jungle hospital. And it was there that I met the John family, Klaus and Martina, a German couple, and they were working there as the surgeon and pediatrician in the hospital there. And we worked together there for about 5 years. And then they had this desire to go and start a new project somewhere where people were unreached for Christ. And they did a tour all through South America to sort of identify where are these areas that are not being evangelized yet. And through a series of events, they ended up in Curuwasi. And they really felt this was the place that they should, that's in the highlands of the Andes Mountains in Peru, southeastern Peru. And when they came back, they were all excited and they said to me, hey, Lyndall, why don't you come and join us in that? And it just sounded to me like a great adventure. And the work in the hospital in Ecuador at that time was changing because the directors had decided to start nationalizing the hospital or handing it over to the Ecuadorians to run and manage themselves, which effectively meant that all the missionaries would be out of a job per se. So it just seemed like a great opportunity. And that's how I ended up in a little town called Curuwasi.
And what year did you end up there?
That was in 2005.
Okay. So when we first met you, in 2015. I don't want to get the number wrong, but you had taken in how many kids?
Nine
kids. I was going to say 10, so I was going to let you have one more. How did that come about?
Yeah. I mean, I did have 11 at one point, but the ones that sort of stayed with me long term were 9.
Okay.
It happened all very accidentally from my point of view, but nothing accidentally from God's point of view. I had started a program, what we call the backpack ministry, which was to provide school supplies for the poorest kids in town whose parents wouldn't be able to afford the school supplies that they would need to go to school. And I met this family through that program, a single mother with 6 boys who came and asked if I could help. Actually, she only asked if I could help one, the oldest one, to go to school. And I said, what about these others? She said, oh, they'll have their turn later. But anyway, I was able to get them all in there. And part of the program, or part of my plan, wasn't really a program back then. It was just something that God put on my heart to help as he provided the funds. And I always went to visit in the houses these families, because I wanted them to know that it wasn't really me that was just giving them backpacks, that it was because God loves them and God really wants them to be part of his children. So, and then this particular mother had some serious health issues, and she ended up passing away very suddenly in her sleep one night, and here were these 6 boys that are suddenly orphaned. And over there, there's a stigma, superstition towards children that are orphans. The local people sort of think that they're cursed, more or less, because you know, if God was blessing them, they would have their parents still. That's sort of the logic. So not many people will take in any orphans. Usually they get sent to big sort of rancheros, where big farms where they'll work as sort of more or less slave labor, because they just get their place to sleep and their food to keep them strong enough to work. But they're not educated. They're not well treated. Nobody, you know, is there to sort of love and nurture them. And at the funeral, this was what was going to happen to these kids. The family's members, extended family members, had decided that they, you know, that they should go off and to one of these farms and see who would take them. And it broke my heart, because I could see these boys ranging in age from 3 to 14, sort of sitting together in one corner of the yard where they were doing the wake, and could obviously hear this conversation that was going on. And, you know, during the time that I had known their mother, I'd been able to bring her to Christ. So I knew that she was, you know, rejoicing with Jesus. But I knew as well her biggest fear was, if she would die, what would happen to her boys?
Yeah.
And it was so important for her that they could stay together. So basically, I went over to them and I said, I didn't really like what I was hearing, and if they wanted to, they could come and live with me. I said, you know, you talk about it and think about it. And then I left, actually, and went home. A little bit later, there's a knock on my front door and here's these boys. And then it really hit me. I thought, I haven't really thought this through, because I'm a single lady here and I'm working full time. But anyway, God worked that out, and that's how I ended up with the first 6. And then the other 3 came along through and my work in the mission hospital there.
That's really cool. Was there like any time between you telling them that they could come stay with you and them coming that you're like, what did I do? Like, obviously it was something that God called you to do and you spoke in confidence of that, but did it ever, like, I don't know, did you ever have those thoughts of like, I can't do this. I'm not prepared for this. I can't handle this. Because I know that has to be a crazy situation.
I was more concerned about my home mission because the home mission in their policies says that single women aren't allowed to adopt children and remain as missionaries.
Okay.
Because the theory is you can't work full time and take care of your kids, right? Mm. So you would have to resign. And I thought, well, I've offered these kids a place to live, but on the other hand, I'm probably going to have to go, like the mission is going to tell me to resign. So how am I going to make this work? I've spoken without thinking this through. And so I wrote to my mission and I wrote to my home church and just explained the situation. And I said to the mission, you know, you could consider this letter my resignation because I know that's the policy. And to my home church, I said, this is what's happened. And I come from a very conservative church, so, you know, where they think it has to be a mum and a dad with kids. Yeah. And I believe that as well, wherever it's possible, but it obviously doesn't always work out that way. And God, I just saw God work his hand in that, because the mission director wrote back and said, I don't understand why you're resigning. And so I wrote back and I said, well, because in the handbook it says this. And then he said, oh, I never noticed that. He's like, oh, look, it's not like you actively went out and looked to adopt children. These are ones that, to me, it's very clear he sent them to you. So consider that part of your ministry.
That's awesome.
And that was just a huge, I think it's a huge miracle that God worked in that. And then with my home church as well, they said basically, oh, you know, good on you for that. We hope you survive it. and we're going to have to raise more support so that you can so that you'll have the money to raise them. Another huge miracle for me, knowing the situation. And and the last miracle that God worked in that, so the hospital I was working in, the mission hospital, I went and talked to the directors there, the ones that I worked with in Ecuador, and I said, this is what's happened, and I don't know how it's going to work with working full-time and calling the hospital and then having these kids. And they said, no problem, you can just work school hours. So, yeah, God just put it all into place. And it was a real lesson to me about sometimes you don't need to just wait and ask God to show you or make it clear. Sometimes it's really clear what you should do. And if you think it through too much, you can talk yourself out of it.
Definitely. You know? But definitely.
Just take that step of faith. If you believe God's calling you to something, take that first step of faith and he'll take care of the rest.
That's good. Yeah, because there's a lot of times when we're called to something that in our own mind makes no sense at all. Most of the stuff that God would call us to do, if we actually thought it over in a human mindset, it makes no sense at all. Something that we say at our church a lot is things of the kingdom will never make sense on earth just because it's backwards. It's upside down. It's like the whole logic of, oh, you want to be better financially, give more away. That doesn't make sense, but in the kingdom it works. And yeah, so I think that's really cool how you were able to hear that and then act on that. When we got to Peru, it was at the start of a children's home. So what happened from you taking in six kids to wanting to start that?
Yeah, so I had the six boys there, and really very soon after, there was another boy, 8 years old, who came into the hospital with a badly broken leg. He ended up being abandoned there. It's a long story, so I won't go into it, but his parents didn't want him back. The short version of the story is, if a child is crippled, they can't help on the farm, and then so they're just sort of dead weight. They can't contribute to the family. So he came to live with me, and I thought, oh, I've already got six, so one more won't make any difference. And then there was another boy who came who had kidney failure and needed dialysis. The same sort of story. Dad just left him there, and when we said we can't cure him but we can treat him, the dad just walked away. And I always say that boy Hulbert was the boy that the other boys adopted rather than me, because he was in the hospital for a long time. They were trying to find out where the dad was, how to contact him and send him home. He was there for some months, and when I would be at work on the weekends, sometimes the boys would just come and hang out outside. There's a playground there and that sort of thing. And anyway, they met Hulbert and they talked to him. And then when I came out from finishing the work I was doing, they said, "Mum, there's another kid just like us. He needs to come and live with us." And I said, "Who?" You know, and they said, "Oh, his name's Hulbert." And I knew about him, obviously, but I said, "Well, you know, there's already seven of you there and there's no spare rooms." And one of the boys pipes up and says, "Oh, he can share with me." And I said, "Well, we also don't have any beds. I'll sleep on the floor." He can sleep in the bed, you know. And because, you know, Hulbert's situation was that he had a chronic illness, so I said, you know, it's going to take a lot of time as well, because he needs constant medical attention. And they said, "We'll do everything." And it was almost, you know, how kids, when they're begging for a puppy, "I'll do everything. I'll feed it and I'll walk it." this is sort of a similar thing, only with a human. Mm. So anyway, that's how Hulbert arrived. And I thought, oh, well, seven, one more might make a difference. And then the same with the others. And then when it got to a point where there was actually 11 kids living in the house there, you can imagine how crazy that was.
Oh, I'm sure.
I sort of said it half jokingly and half serious to God, you know, "I know I've always said one more won't make a difference, but right now I think if there's one more, that might be the finish of me." And it was then that God just gave me this vision of what we need is a children's home. We need a children's home where kids can come, and where it's not just dependent on the strength and the resources of one person, but that multiple people can come and and take care.
That's really cool. I know whenever we were there, one of the big things that you guys talked about is that you didn't just want people to come in and help, is that you wanted couples to come in and be parents, that you wanted people to stay there and actually be on property and not just be like employees or people that just helped out there, but you wanted people that actually like were parents to these kids. And I always thought that was really cool, because I mean, I know just the short time that we were able to spend with you guys over there, like it's so much more than just helping the kids. Like it's actually giving the kids like a sense of belonging. And like, I will never forget just like seeing the joy on kids in this area, like every time they got to see you, just because like they know who you are and they knew that like you genuinely cared for them, like you genuinely loved them, like you weren't just helping them out of some religious, you know, sense of obligation, like you genuinely cared for the kids. And I think that's something that was really cool to see whenever we were there, is just the genuine joy that these kids have. Was it hard to be there taking in all of these kids? And I say, was it hard? Of course it was, taking in all of these kids. And obviously that meant that, like, you couldn't really take time to go home. How often did you get to go back to Australia?
While I was raising them, I think I only went twice for 1 month at a time. And, you know, God was very gracious there, because generally, if you sign up to a mission, to go out overseas somewhere, they give you a whole list of things that you need to do, and how to raise support, and how often you should come back to Australia, you know, to your home country, so that you keep your supporters informed. And they have graphs and statistics about, you know, how many people will promise to support, and actually how many actually get around to supporting you. So they want you to support, to raise sort of 120% of your needed support, because they know people are going to drop off. And I prayed when I first got that letter from the mission 20 odd years ago. I prayed and I said, Lord, I believe you're sending me, and you've promised to provide for my needs. So I'm not going to do a business model on raising support. I'm going to just leave that in your hands, and your as long as you provide, I'll take it as the sign that I'm supposed to stay. And as long as I can't, once I can't, I'll think, well, you're saying it's time to go back home. And so when I couldn't get back, I did write to the churches and say, you know, I won't be able to do the same thing as I had done in previous times, and this is why. Yeah, in the years that I was raising the boys, my support never dropped.
That's so never cool. Dropped. God, definitely just all God.
Yeah, and some of the boys had some chronic illnesses and things, mm-hmm. like Huber's treatment for dialysis was costing us about $3,000 a month. I thought, I don't know how this is going to work. But God provided every single month that he needed it, until we got a home dialysis machine that was donated. And then the cost dropped significantly, but it's still a lot if you've already got sort of 9, 10, 11 kids in the house.
Yeah.
Having extra costs. Another one of the boys had a growth problem. He didn't have a pituitary gland, which means he couldn't grow without help, because the pituitary gland produces the growth hormone. And so he had to have daily injections for 2 years, and oh. Every one of those injections costs $100.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I said to him, look, we'll do it as long as we can, but I don't know that we'll be able to do 2 years worth of it. And anyway, God provided it. God provided it. And he provided it through some missionaries that had been to Kurawasi and then gone home because their time was up, through visitors like yourself. I mean, you didn't donate to that, but visitors like yourself that just come for a shorter time. Yeah. And hear stories and are impacted. They go home back to their jobs and they're like, I really want to help. And I just was always amazed how God provided each time for every need.
That's so cool. So what has it been like now that, at least for the time being, you're back in Australia? How is that going?
Yeah, so it wasn't something that I chose for myself, just by a chance finding. While I was over in Kurawasi, I was diagnosed with cancer, with stage 4 cancer, and had to leave very quickly. Yeah, I felt sort of cheated by God in the beginning, and I thought, here I have served you all this time, and now this is what you give me. And just working through all that as the tests back in Australia came through, and it became basically the diagnosis was that I have incurable cancer. So incurable but treatable. I just thought, how could God just allow that to happen? And yet, God, when I cried out to him right in the beginning, and he basically said, well, why not you? You know, why not you? Trust me. And over the course of some months, you know, I was able to work through it. And I thought, here I have spent almost 20 years overseas telling people how important God is, how the only thing that matters is your relationship with Christ, is that you have your eternal salvation sort of in your back pocket there. Nothing else matters. And God used that, you know, put it in my heart to see that now's my time to live that as a truth and not just pretty words that say, you know, forget about everything here. What you need is to look to the long goal, not what's happening here.
Yeah.
And and God has given me really a piece about that yes, you know, if this is it for me, then wow, when I think back about what I've been able to do, where I've been able to go, the people I've met, the people I can call friends and family, what a privilege that God has given me those 20 years to serve him and to impact people's lives. And honestly, you know, there's that verse that Paul says, for me to live as Christ and to die as gain.
Yeah,
I really have come to understand that, I think, through the cancer, is that if every day, every moment that God gives me is his, you know, is to live for him, is to be a witness to him and to use that for his glory. And when he decides to take me home, wow, what a prize, right? What a prize. Go there and just spend eternity. My job's done and I can spend eternity. So what started out as a shocking, seeming like very dark sort of thing, God has turned that as well into something that I can just thank him for. And I'm excited to see what the future is as much as God gives me.
Hopefully I know that's definitely not like the easiest attitude to have towards something like that, but like the way that you show Christ in your attitude is probably like the main reason that you were one of the first people that I thought of that should be on this podcast. And when I had that thought, like I knew nothing about the cancer or any of that. So just to hear the way that God is teaching you through that is incredible, and to hear your attitude toward that, and just to understand that it's not just your words, but your entire life points to Christ. That is just an absolutely beautiful thing. I know we were talking within the past few months about you going back to Peru. When all this COVID stuff maybe lets that happen, what are your plans for getting back there, and like maybe some things that you're wanting to do whenever you get back there?
I think one of the biggest lessons that I've learned about being pulled out of the ministry so quickly is humility, actually. Yeah. Because I was in charge of everything over there, and you know, as a human, your instinct is to think, oh, they won't be able to do it without
me. Yeah, for sure.
You know, that they'll flounder, and maybe the ministry will die because I'm not there. And God's shown me that's not the case at all. And the humility part as well is in that he uses other people, they may not do it the same way that I would have chosen to do it, but they're called by God as well. And if they get the job done, they get the job done. That's the most important thing. And so it's been really, as well to me, inspiring and just wonderful to see how people have stepped up. Local people, you know, Peruvians that I've had contact with for so many years, stepping into roles, taking up the slack, let's say, that my absence has taken, but just to see them doing his work, you know. And I look at it and I think, well, probably if I'd been there, they wouldn't have felt the need. Even if God was pushing them to it, they wouldn't have felt the need, because Lyndall's there to do it.
Yeah.
Also just maybe I wouldn't have let them if I'd been there, because I think, well, that's what I do. So God's used it to teach me that he can use anyone, and he really can. If you just open your heart, say, God, I'm here. I want to be obedient, and I trust you to, you know, keep me and enable me for whatever you're calling me to. God can do wonderful things, and you have just that opportunity to see God working, in your own eyes, not just hearing how God has worked in other people. That's just so inspiring.
Definitely. So on an ending note, if there's someone hearing this podcast and they feel God calling them to do something, whether it's something like your calling was, kind of like a drop everything and go, or something that is more, you know, stay at home but still actively doing something, any calling that someone feels like they might have, what is some encouragement that you might have for doing it, just stepping out and doing it?
Yeah, I'm reminded of two stories in the Bible. One is Moses. Remember when God called Moses to save the Egyptians, and Moses had all the excuses. I can't talk, I'm too young, I don't know what to do. And God constantly answered and said, I'll do it for you. I'll help you. I'll give you the words. I'll do it. So don't psych yourself out with thinking, I'm no good at that. You know, I wouldn't know what to do. Because if God has put that on your heart, he's going to equip you. And he probably already has equipped you. You just haven't activated those skills that he's already put in you. And the second one is Joshua and the Israelites, when God was taking them into the promised land. And, you know, they had the big Jordan River there that they had to cross. Well, God didn't, if you note in the story, God didn't part the seas and then they crossed like with Moses and the Israelites. The priests had to go ahead, and when they stepped into the water, God parted the river and they could cross. So you don't have to know every detail of what God's calling you to do. If he's saying go, or if he's saying stay, or if he's saying speak to that person, you make the first step and God will take care of the rest. And you'll just stand there amazed, you know, if it's to talk to someone and you feel really intimidated or fearful, you know, open your mouth, say g'day, and then you'll be amazed at how God just puts those thoughts of what to speak into your mind, because God loves those people much more than we do. And he wants them all to be saved.
So good. And I can definitely relate firsthand to the argument Moses had. Is that was my biggest argument with everything I felt called to do ever, is, but God, I don't speak well. Why do you want me to do speaking? And he's like, yeah, don't worry about what you do well. Just let me do it. I just need you to let me work through you. And it's just understanding that I've kind of come to a point now where I believe if it was something that I was naturally good at, then God wouldn't get the glory. So for me to act out and do something that may not come natural to me is how God gets the glory. And so, yeah, I agree 100%. Is God will equip you as you're doing it, as you continue to go. You just have to take one step at a time. So yeah, thank you for being on here with us, and thank you for sharing just a small portion of your story, but it's so powerful. And thank you for hearing God and obeying God. And we will definitely be praying for you as you continue to go through treatment and as you're trying to get back to Peru as well.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to chat and to share a little bit. And I hope it has encouraged some people who maybe are at that point in their life. They feel God calling them to something and they feel ill-prepared, just to take heart that God's there and he'll give us everything we need.
So good. Well, thank you guys for joining us on the podcast, and we hope and pray that something that was talked about spoke to you today.